From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. Today's guest, Tony Mendoza, will be at the Thurber House on August 6th, reading from his latest book, A Cuban Summer. Ticket information is available at www.craftheshow.com.
I'm Kayla Geyer, and I'm here with Tony Mendoza, a photographer and author. Hello, Tony.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Great. So your latest work is Cuban Summer, which is a coming-of-age novel set in 1954 in Cuba, before Castro. In 1999, you published Cuba Going Back, which documented your return to Cuba after a 36-year absence. What made you decide to write a story placed in a time before you left Cuba?
This latest book, I thought it was like a good follow-up to the book of going to Cuba, finding out what life was like there, and getting a feel for that new world of socialist Cuba and so on. And at some point, it made a lot of sense to try to do a book about what life was like in Cuba before. So that's kind of the simple answer. It was like a companion book that actually went back to Cuba before all this socialism and all that. But that's kind of the short answer in my mind. The longer answer...
I'm ready for it.
...is that the work that I've done has been mostly in photography, and the most successful things I've done in photography have been projects that have combined little stories with photographs. So the first book I did was a book about my life with a cat in a New York loft. And there were a lot of very nice pictures of this cat, black and white pictures. I spent like 2 years photographing the cat every day. And then I took all these pictures, put it in a box, and took it to publishing agents and publishers in New York. Nobody wanted to publish the book. I got like 50 rejections. And then somebody said, you know, you can't publish a book unless there's a story. So I said, okay, I'll write a story. So I went back, wrote this really simple story about my life with a cat, and in the book I speak about my impressions of living with this cat, and then the cat speaks, and that's in italics when he speaks, about his impressions of living with a photographer. So I did this in 1 weekend. That next week, I send it to a publisher with a text, and the moment the publisher saw it, he said, let's do it, let's publish it. So that kind of picked my attention about the combination of writing and photography. So the next project was a book about stories of my life. I figured, okay, I've written a story of me and a cat. How about stories of me when I was in Cuba, when I was younger, when I left Cuba, when I moved to the U.S., and little stories, and I had plenty of pictures from family albums, or I was starting to take pictures. So I started writing these stories, very short, one paragraph. So after about 3 years' work, I published the book, and that was incredibly quick. The first one, I got like 50 rejections. On this one, the first person who saw it wanted to publish it. Mm-hmm. So that book got reviewed and did well critically, not so well commercially. It was kind of a weird book. But then so that was in 1987. And at that moment, I thought, wow, it seems that I have a knack of writing one-paragraph stories. So in 1987, I figured, okay, why don't I write a novel? So I took a story in that book and expanded it.
Oh, okay.
And started working on expanding that thing, and it was a story that took place in Havana in 1954. And I figured, okay, I'll just expand it. I'll fill it up and fill it in and see what happened after that story. And that's what got me going in this book. So that was in 1987, and this book was published in 2014. So the long story is 87, 97, 07, 20, what? 20-some years. My math is terrible. So every summer I've been working on this novel by rewriting and adding things and, you know, refining it and doing things here and there. And so for 20 years I've been writing this book.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You said at the age of 18 you moved with your family to the U.S. How did you feel when you had to leave Cuba?
I felt great. I basically, I'm an American lover of the way things are here as compared to the way things were in Cuba. So to me, it wasn't like a big move because I had gone to an American prep school. And in a nutshell, I just love the way dating occurred in America as compared to the way dating occurred in Cuba. So in Cuba, we, you know, 15-year-old boys, 16, 17-year-old boys had to bring along a chaperone when we went out on a date. And that's in the 50s. That's the way it was. And not only you had to bring along a chaperone, but you had to pay for her drinks at the bar.
So in America or Cuba?
No, in Cuba. Are you kidding? In America? In America, forget it.
You just don't have to pay for anything.
Well, you know, in America, you never have the custom of chaperones. But in the 50s, that custom was going on strong in Cuba. So in my trips to the U.S., because I went to an American high school, when I was able to get out on weekends and go out on dates, it was great. You know, there were no chaperones. American girls necked. Cuban girls did not. So everything was great. So when...
I'm sure it was great.
So when the time came to leave Cuba, what I thought was, great, I'm going to live in America full time. This is good.
You're going to get to neck full time. Just amazing. So when you returned to Cuba, did you have the same feeling you got when you were a teenager living there? Because you were gone for like 36 years, correct, before you returned?
Well, you know, by that time, I'd grown up and done things and become an artist. And, you know, I was quite different from when I was a teenager running around Havana. But I went, you know, as a journalist more than anything. I kind of knew that I had a lot of questions about Cuba that I'd been thinking about for years. The main one being, you know, how do people accept, you know, the socialist regime that pays them very little? And, you know, how do they deal with having a government that doesn't allow for a lot of things that we take for granted? And so I wanted to find out how people navigated socialism. And, you know, and I went to Cuba with a whole bunch of questions, and every person I met, I would ask them certain questions about how do they earn a living, how did they put food on the table, you know, how did they relate to the government, these kind of things. So I wasn't really thinking about reliving Cuba or anything. I was thinking, okay, how do people here manage? So, and I, all along, I thought I'd write a book and I would combine it with pictures. So I was a workaholic. I'd get up really early, hit the streets, talk to anybody who would talk to me, take pictures, and run around all day bothering people till, and I would last till midnight and I would go to the clubs, and I keep going with a camera and interviewing people. I had a tape recorder, the whole thing. And for 2 weeks, I just talked to everyone that I could. So I wasn't really getting into, oh, I'm in Cuba, let me relax and enjoy this. I was doing a job.
Not on vacation.
Yeah, I wasn't on vacation.
You started writing Cuban Summer like in 1987 then.
Right. But, you know, when I started writing that thing, I wasn't really very adept at writing anything long. Everything I've done up to then was writing paragraphs, which I would combine with a photograph. So that was something I felt very comfortable with and I could do and so on. But when I started writing this longer thing, I realized I didn't know what I was doing. So I realized I had to take some creative writing courses, and I started doing that. Whenever I got a job teaching photography, which was the skill I had, and I started doing visiting artist gigs, I would always take a creative writing class in that place where I was teaching. So I taught at Southwest Missouri State, took a class there. Then I taught at a college in New Jersey in Monmouth County. I took a class there. And then I got a tenure-track job at Ohio State teaching photography. And I took classes there. So by 1990-95, now I felt I had enough skills to write the novel. And then I started again from scratch, and I've been doing that ever since.
Right. But you were initially trained in architecture, right? In
worse than
engineering.
That, yeah. I was initially trained as an engineer for the very simple reason that my father was an engineer and he owned a factory in Cuba that made prefabricated housing. So I figured my father would give me a job if I studied engineering. But I realized that I was not fit to be an engineer, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing as an engineer. So after 1 year of designing railroad bridges in New York City, I went to architectural school.
Okay.
And one of my jokes is that throughout my life, I made sure never to take the train that crosses the bridge that I designed because my bridge got built.
So that was the shift that caused you to switch to the fine arts then?
Yeah, architecture is kind of like the combination of engineering and art. And it was good. It was a wonderful career. I highly recommend it to anybody who doesn't know what they're going to do in life, because I think in my class of 30-some students that majored in architecture in 1968, I think four are architects. The little I've kept up with the class, everybody else is kind of loosely in the arts as writers, cinematographers, movie makers, photographers, actors, you name it. So it was like a wonderful career to open up possibilities because the architectural field is very, very difficult and very few people can actually survive in it.
So how did your dad take it?
My dad, who was kind of a businessman type, he was always horrified. The moment I quit architecture, which I did pretty quickly, after I graduated from architectural school, I lasted 1 year as an engineer and 3 years as an architect. And then I became a photographer. And my dad was horrified. He thought I was the stupidest guy on the planet, you know, becoming a photographer. And then when I showed him what I was doing as a photographer, I was photographing a cat. He nearly flipped. And he kept telling me, you should be photographing beautiful women.
Ernie was pretty cool, though. Did he get his name from Ernie. The book? Or
That was his name.
Okay, did you name him?
No. When I moved to New York City, I answered an ad from a painter, and she wanted to share her loft with another artist. So I interviewed and got accepted, and Ernie was her cat. And for the next, like, 2 or 3 years, I photographed that cat. I didn't have money to go out and do anything in New York City, so I stayed in the loft, photographed the cat, and pretty soon I figured, okay, this is either a book or an art show or something, because the pictures I was taking were unusual, were a little different from most cat pictures. And sure enough, I did show it in galleries, and eventually that book was published, and the book did very well. It immediately sold out.
Everybody likes cats.
Yeah. Cat books, they say that any photography book with a cat on the cover is worth 20,000 copies sold, and with a dog on the cover, 40,000 copies sold. So cats, dogs, it's good.
How did your roommate feel about her cat?
Oh, she was great because I made her cat very well known in the art world.
Okay. So switching gears, currently you're an instructor of photography at OSU. You are living quite the eventful life. How has that impacted how you teach and what you bring to the classroom?
Well, just to bring you up to date, I used to be.
Oh, you used to be?
Yeah, a professor in the art department at OSU. And I was there for 25 years, and I retired last year.
Okay.
So basically, I figured, okay, I've done that. Now I want to get back to my roots, which was being an artist. So I feel pretty young and energetic, even though I'm 73. And I figured, you know, I still have it in me to go out there and be a starving artist again, because my pension is terrible. And just, that's how I started. You know, I never thought I would teach as a career. I just found out I couldn't really pay for health insurance being a freelance artist. And then I got married. And the moment we had to support a family and a kid and then two kids, forget it, being a freelance artist. So then I apply for teaching jobs. But it's a good way for an artist to earn a living. And at Ohio State, they're very keen on research. So that's great because you teach, 3 days a week, pretty much, is how it works. And then you have 4 days a week to do your art, do your research, and keep going.
Okay.
So it was good. But even those 3 days a week, I thought it was terrible infringement in my freedom to do art full time. And I had to worry about being a good teacher and all that. You know, no teacher wants to be a bad teacher. And no teacher has any self-confidence whatsoever. So I worried a lot about doing it right and being a good teacher. And since I've retired, I don't worry about that. It feels really good. So the problem now is I have all this time in my hand, and at times I don't know what to do. But it's a very nice problem to have.
Right. I mean, I'm jealous of that problem.
Yeah.
You can always find another cat.
Right. Well, we have a cat. We have a dog. Now I'm doing a dog book.
I saw that. That's the one I was looking for.
Yeah, and I'm in the process of publishing it, and I'm talking to a publisher, and we're going back and forth. I'm showing him, the signs for the book, which you can knock out and blurb very quickly, and then he'll come back with suggestions. So I think this is good because he's staying with me, and I have a feeling it'll probably get published.
Probably will. Like you said, it's about a dog. So
yeah,
that
exactly.
Helps.
Yes.
So was your teaching experience good then? Did you meet a lot of starving artists that you could help along the way?
I think teaching is an honorable profession. I liked it. I think it's good. And from the point of view of helping people, you know, I don't know how much help you can be to someone aspiring to be an artist. I think they're going to have to make it on their own. And they're going to have to get that energy and that ambition and that drive somehow, magically. I don't know how teachers can affect that. But from my point of view, I enjoyed dealing with young people all my life. They kept me on my toes. A lot of things I learned from my students. So I miss that aspect of not teaching, sort of having people who are much younger than me, who are very smart and savvy about many things I'm not. And that's something I miss.
Yeah. Well, you're smart and savvy. So. Yeah. Tony Mendoza, thank you so much for being here today. I look forward to your reading at the Thurber House August 6th.
Great. Well, I hope that people will come and listen to the reading. If I can plug it, it's actually a very, very funny book, a little taste of what it was like to grow up in Havana in the 50s in a pretty crazy city. And I took part in its craziness and try to capture a little bit of that in this book.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.